May it please the court, Kate Aronson representing appellant Lamar Tan. Good morning. There are two issues in the case. The first is a Caldwell issue, and that is whether the officers extended the duration of the stop or engaged in investigatory activities beyond those reasonably necessary to carry out the initial purpose of the stop. If yes, a separate seizure occurs, and then the question becomes whether the officers can identify specific articulable facts, providing an independent justification for the additional intrusion. The second issue with respect to Mr. Tan is whether the police had probable cause to arrest Mr. Tan at the time he was handcuffed and arrested. With respect to the Caldwell issue, the officers in this case exceeded the permissible scope of the traffic stop and lacked at that point in time additional facts sufficient to justify the second seizure. The initial stop of Tan's vehicle was not to effect an arrest. It was for the purpose of a seatbelt violation for the passenger. When he is stopped for that seatbelt violation, he appears nervous, but he nonetheless provides valid documentation. At the time he is providing that documentation, officers notice commercially packaged sandwich bags that can be bought in a grocery store in a box on the back seat of the car. Mr. Turner, the front seat passenger, has an outstanding capias. He also is in possession, as he discloses to the police officer, of approximately $700 in cash. When Mr. Tan's identification is run, it is learned that he has a six-year-old arrest for a possession of a weapon with an obliterated serial number. Mr. Holmes, the rear passenger, his identification checks out. He has no warrants. Neither Tan nor Holmes are acting suspiciously, other than Mr. Tan appears nervous. The conversation is not in any way deceptive by Mr. Tan. He asks the officer, what's the problem? The problem is described as a seatbelt. Mr. Tan says, oh. At the point in time that Mr. Turner is taken out of that vehicle on that outstanding capias and handcuffed and arrested, there's an insufficient independent justification to continue the detention. A citation should have been issued at that point, and Mr. Holmes and Mr. Turner sent on their way.
How do you get, or how did this case get, from stopping someone for a seatbelt violation to asking everyone in the car to identify themselves? I'm just thinking, if you pull someone over and say, you didn't have your seatbelt on, is it normal police procedure to then ask everyone in the car to identify themselves?
This court has permitted identification of passengers for a number of reasons. One being so that if a report is subsequently made, such as in the Williams Community Caretaker Doctrine case, the officers are able to document who they had contact with, et cetera. So yes, this court has permitted it in the past. But when there's no warrants that check out, and you're left with sandwich baggies, a defendant who is now in custody on a warrant check, who has some cash on him, there's no reasonable basis at that point to continue the detention. And what it becomes is, under Caldwell, without an independent facts warranting that investigation, the second seizure occurs of Mr. Tan. And Superior Court, in its opinion, actually misstated the record with respect to one fact. In the opinion on page 8, Judge Johnston indicated that Tan reached underneath the driver's seat immediately before he was asked to step outside the vehicle, behavior consistent with concealing contraband. The officer clearly testified that the decision was made to take Mr. Tan out of the vehicle based on the baggies and the cash and on Mr. Turner and the 2003 arrest for officer safety. At the time, it is after he is asked to exit the vehicle that he reaches under that seat. And at that point, while seated in the vehicle, he is handcuffed. He is arrested at that point without probable cause. The second seizure occurs at the time that he is arrested, when in fact he should have been released with Holmes with a traffic citation issued at that point.
If you take that fact that you believe was misstated out of the analysis by the trial judge, where did she go wrong? Because she did decide there was sufficient articulable, reasonable articulable suspicion.
The question for this court is whether those, where the four facts are reasonable articulable suspicion of drug activity. And the four facts are visibly nervous, plastic baggies, a report by Mr. Turner, the passenger, that's overheard by one officer that he has $700 in cash, and an uncorroborated, unsubstantiated tip. And in this particular case, the police officer himself indicated in his testimony on page 50, there's a lot of grand marquees in that area, so it could well have been that vehicle, or it could well have not been that vehicle. So that tip in and of itself has no corroboration. The officer is not attributing any significance to it because there's many grand marquees in that area, as he testified. So then we're left with commercially packaged sandwich bags on the back seat of a car.
Well, why does it matter whether or not the officer is paying attention to it? Isn't this an objective analysis?
It is an objective analysis, but it is an objective analysis. And when objectively you look at the facts that are relied on, those four, by the trial court, it's still not sufficient for reasonable articulable suspicion of drug activity.
Well, aren't there two more, at least, with the outstanding warrant and the prior weapons conviction?
Well, actually, the prior weapons conviction is also a misstatement of the facts. There is an arrest to which the officer is aware when he runs Mr. Tan's license through Delgis. He sees that it's an arrest. He has no information regarding the disposition of that charge, and he testified to that in the hearing. But what's interesting about trial court's opinion is the trial court, based on the four facts, as I've just discussed, says there's reasonable suspicion, and then goes into a next paragraph saying escalating the officer's suspicion. So the trial judge only relied on those four facts, and that's on page 8 of the trial court's opinion.
And why was that error? Why were those four facts insufficient?
Because in Caldwell, nervousness and perspiration weren't enough. In Caldwell, nervousness plus giving incredible information that I don't know the name of my passenger wasn't enough. And in this case, you have nervousness and sandwich bags on the back seat that could have been for any purpose. They could have been for pretzels. They could have been for anything. And the fact that one person says, I have some money on me, and was candid about it, and then the cop arrests him on a warrant, counts the money, and at $695, it was completely consistent. You don't have suspicious activity by the driver or the backseat passenger. You don't have lying to the cop the way that we've had in other cases in which suspiciousness and misleading the police or refusing to answer questions or...
Well, let me stop you there. You may seem to make a big deal about the fact that these sandwich bags could have been for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, right? But a police officer also knows that those are the kinds of bags that are used to hold drugs, right? So in terms of having a basis or a reasonable suspicion, this is not just out of the air. You know, the police officer sees that and says, one reasonable use of this, based upon my experience as a police officer, is that this is an indication of somebody involved in drugs. Well, you know, and I understand that it also could mean nothing, but isn't that the way it always is, that certain, you know, somebody can be nervous and it's just because they're nervous, not because they're hiding something. So there are always usually there are two possible interpretations of whatever quote-unquote evidence there is, but doesn't it deserve respect, if you will, that a police officer says, you know, I see the box of baggies, and that raises an additional suspicion that there's drug involvement. What's wrong with that?
There is nothing wrong with that, in that you have certain facts that could be construed either innocuously or as evidence of criminal activity. But when you look specifically at these facts, and they're not those facts in and of themselves, when they have an equally innocuous explanation, and you don't have deception or suspicious activity by the parties that are in that vehicle, then it's appellant's position, it's simply not enough.
Let me, you know, get at this in a slightly different way. You know, this building on Justice Berger's, you know, hypothetical interpretation of the facts that the police officer, you know, did have, was able to perceive. Is it your position that what you have here are two different versions? That is, you have a reasonable, articulable suspicion of drug activity on the one hand, and an equally reasonable, articulable suspicion of no crime on the other? Or is your position that the scenario is that, that the scenario that Justice Berger described may be articulable but not reasonable?
It is certainly not the former. My position is certainly not Your Honor's former hypothetical. It's when the question comes down to whether facts that could be construed in one way or equally innocuously in another way. Is there something else in this case that would tip the scale toward a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity? Because the facts in and of themselves in this case are not enough to tip it.
Maybe I'm being too tied up with the doctrine, but, you know, humor me. What I'm hearing is that you may be able to articulate a suspicion that Mr. Tan was involved in some drug-related crime, but it's not reasonable. It's not a reasonable suspicion, even though it's articulable, because there's an equally plausible, innocent explanation for what the officer perceived.
Correct. There might be a hunch based on facts that have a reasonable interpretation of non-criminal activity, but that was not enough for that hunch to then become reasonable suspicion. Unless the court has any further questions.
You want to save 2 minutes?
Yes, sir. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. Chris Tees on behalf of Quentin Turner, who actually took his case to trial. And two issues are raised in the brief, Your Honor. The first being that the trial court erred in instructing the jury on accomplice liability. The second being the Heath case, a Superior Court decision that would challenge perhaps the initial stop. I'll begin with the accomplice instruction. The facts of the case, I think, are important for my client, Mr. Turner. You know, in the purest argument he would make to a jury is, I got into a car, I had $695 on me, and the two other guys had drugs on them. Therefore, you cannot find me guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The state indicated to the trial court that through its expert, it would demonstrate that an accomplice instruction was proper. That expert took the stand. His testimony was that, I think clearly, that Mr. Turner was acting as a principal, that he was involved in a drug enterprise with these two other individuals who he knew, who were friends. And the detective went on to explain how one would hold money, one would have the drugs packaged, one would have a larger quantity, who would be the actual higher up than the ones with the packaging. The defense argument at trial was that there was not sufficient evidence for that instruction. because the state's own expert did not provide a basis for accomplice liability. Accomplice liability and conspiracy through the statutes are similarly have similar language, where really the only difference, it appears to counsel, is the word agreement in conspiracy. I think the state even concedes that in this case his belief was that Mr. Turner could be guilty both as an accomplice and a conspirator. That's not the position taken by the defense. Our position is that because the language in each statute is so similar, it would be easy for a jury to be confused by the meaning of accomplice liability versus the meaning of a conspiracy. And the inclusion of that instruction, when there really was no evidence for it, could likely have confused the jury in carrying out its function.
Which instruction?
The accomplice liability instruction, Your Honor. The defense position is that accomplice liability is a less strict standard than conspiracy because it doesn't require an agreement. At a minimum, it can be simply wanting a criminal enterprise to take place and simply aiding it, cheering it on, whatever the case may be at its minimum. Conspiracy is a higher degree of proof requiring actual agreement. That's why I think the facts are important for Mr. Turner. In its purest form, he gets into a car with $695.
Help me understand this division of labor concept. Hypothetically, three guys, Manny, Moe, and Jack, one's got the drugs, one's got the cash, one's got a weapon. Manny delivers the drugs out the window, but they're all operating in concert.
Yes, sir.
Who's the principal, who's the accomplice under that scenario, in your view? Or are they all principals? Or
I think that would depend. It could depend on the expert's testimony, for one thing. The state would be required to go either way. Either it's an agreement, that they're all in agreement, or it's accomplice liability.
But someone who's indicted as a principal can be convicted as an accomplice.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. The error here, though, was there being no evidence to support the accomplice instruction. The defense is of the mind that you can't simply make every conspiracy an accomplice as well, base a conspiracy on accomplice liability as well. There's got to be a distinction in certain cases where at least present evidence of accomplice liability. We can't just assume that because there's evidence of a conspiracy that somehow satisfies what really is a less strict standard of proof for the state with accomplice liability.
And the evidence that's missing here is what?
The evidence that's missing is any theory that Mr. Turner was acting as an accomplice. The state's case was they were all in agreement together doing this.
Well, wait, let me just make sure I got that one correctly. You're saying that there was no evidence that your client was an accomplice and that the state's evidence was only that they were all the principals?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I'll move on to the suppression issue, if the court approves. Mr. Turner only had standing to contest the seizure of the $695 that was taken from him. It appeared to counsel clearly that removing him from the car and him, I think, spontaneously in response to a question, do you have anything on you, said, I have $695, $700, he said, that at least the Loper case from December covers that under the Fourth Amendment. I don't believe this court has ever specifically addressed Heath, a Superior Court decision by Judge Young that argues the Delaware Constitution could potentially protect Mr. Turner and the other two individuals from this initial stop. The test is, as announced in Heath, would be ultimately whether a reasonable officer acting on this tip would have made this stop based on a passenger not having a seatbelt on. And the officer said he would. He said his testimony at one point was, I would have made the stop anyway. It's a reasonable officer standard, which was not addressed by the lower court, that she didn't take up a Heath analysis. And that's why in my brief, I asked the court to remand it to have that determination made so you could review it, whether the officer was reasonable in carrying out this stop just based on an uncorroborated tip by a confidential informant, not past proven and reliable.
You mentioned Judge Young's Superior Court opinion that either holds or at least at a minimum suggests that somehow under the Delaware Constitution, contrary to the interpretation by the Supreme Court of the United States Constitution, that there that pretextual stops may be unconstitutional in Delaware. It's correct that no other Superior Court judge has followed Judge Young's opinion, isn't it?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
And it wasn't appealed to us?
That's correct, Your Honor. The state did not appeal that decision. Judge Johnston passed. She did talk about it at oral argument, which was not transcribed, as the court is well aware. And she simply asked the parties, you know, I'm not controlled by Heath, am I? And the state said, no, you're not. And she went on to make a bench ruling that was never transcribed. So in that way, she took account of it.
Are you suggesting in this appeal that we should adopt the reasoning that Judge Young used in his case?
I am, Your Honor.
Tell us why. I'm not familiar really with his theory.
His theory, he sets forth a two-step analysis for determining whether a pretextual stop under the Delaware Constitution is legal. The first step being, at the time of the stop, did the officer reasonably believe a traffic offense had taken place? Clearly, there was a traffic offense, the failure to wear a seatbelt. The second step being whether the burden on the defendant to demonstrate whether an unrelated purpose motivated the stop and whether, absent the unrelated hunch or purpose, a reasonable officer would have made the stop. I think, you know, Judge Young was obviously troubled by the vagaries of pretextual stops and what could take place.
Well, what's the underpinning in the Delaware Constitution?
Your Honor, I know it's Article 1, Section 7. It's almost identical language to the federal statute. This court has in the past afforded more protections under the Delaware Constitution. It's never passed on this specific provision.
Yeah, but in the past where we have, there's something specific in the Delaware Constitution that suggests that that was the intent of the framers, that there be greater protection than afforded under the U.S. Constitution. It's not typically an argument that arises when the language is identical.
Your Honor, I believe it is identical. I can't at this moment.
Does he make any, Judge Young, I mean, does he make any distinction between pretextual in the sense of the vehicle crossed the center lane two times or the vehicle failed to put on a turn signal and something that's more concretely cognizable, like a smashed taillight or failure to turn on the headlights because they're broken or something that can be documented? I'm trying to get a feel for his concern about vagaries of pretextual stops. I mean, there are some stops, by way of example here. Was there some contest that, no, I had my seatbelt on and you're just lying so you can investigate us about drugs? Or is it a concession that, yep, you know, I didn't have my seatbelt on, and is arguably as big a waste of time as that could conceivably be for a police officer to pull somebody over because a passenger didn't have on a seatbelt, and they're willing to drive down the road with ding, 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 ding going on in the front of the car all the time. It doesn't seem like a meaningful use of police officers' time, but is it contested that he did or didn't have the seatbelt on?
It's not contested, Your Honor.
How is it pretextual?
Because I think it's, I don't believe a reasonable police officer would make that stop under these circumstances. I think it's very plain, not plain, I would assume the officer made this stop because of that hunch, in spite of his testimony otherwise. Not the hunch, but the tip that was really not corroborated. So I do concede that, Your Honor.
And your point would be that the trial judge didn't consider whether or not that was believable because it didn't make any difference because he didn't have the seatbelt on, and that's a violation of the law.
I think so, Your Honor. And then she basically rejected any Heath argument as being not applicable to the case.
But in terms of whether to apply an objective test or the subjective one, which brings in the pretext concept, is it accurate that only two states have used their state constitutions to find pretextual stops unconstitutional under their state constitutions, whereas 40 states and the District of Columbia have adopted the objective analysis?
I'm sure that's correct, Your Honor. I would welcome the opportunity to be able to address that further through any kind of supplemental memo, but I'm pretty sure that's absolutely right. We are one of the rare states.
Well, at least that's one of what the New York Court of Appeals said in People versus Robinson, that there's more than 40 states in the District of Columbia have adopted the objective standard approved by Wren or cited it with approval.
Again, Your Honor, I would love the opportunity to respond in writing, but I think that's absolutely right.
So you can have the case cited 767 Northeast 2nd 638.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I do note that it appears that 2 minutes are remaining. Is there any other questions you want to respond to?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it please the court, a Fourth Amendment intrusion, of course, must be reasonable both in its inception and in its scope. Mr. Teese's argument focuses on its inception, Ms. Aronson's on its scope, and this court has addressed both, starting with the reasonableness at the inception, the so-called pretext stop, long ago, well before Wren was decided in Trailer versus State, and since Wren, this court discussed it at length in the Caldwell case. And in Trailer, the court simply said, well, the police had probable cause to believe that Mr. Trailer was driving during suspension, so it wasn't a pretext stop, even though their primary motivation was, of course, to search the car for drugs. That's simply immaterial as long as they have probable cause to believe there was a violation. Post-Wren in Caldwell, if I'm reading Caldwell correctly, the court considered the issue of a pretext stop, which was raised, and said, well, we can deal with that if the stop itself in its inception is objectively reasonable. We can deal with the pretext part of it if the officers go beyond the scope of a routine traffic violation. In two cases, both Caldwell and later in Loper, this course defined the scope of a routine traffic violation, the do's and don'ts, what the police can and cannot do. In State v. Heath, the court could very well have decided in that case that there was a Caldwell violation. I mean, that was rather obvious, but there was no reason to focus on the inception aspect. The police went well beyond the scope of a routine traffic violation in that case, as was the case in in Caldwell also. But as long as the stop is reasonable in its inception, and the court in Caldwell pointed out, and I think a very important point, that in Wren, which everybody relies on, in Wren, the District of Columbia police, after they made their so-called pretext stop, walked up to the driver's window, and there in plain view on Wren's lap is a bag of crack cocaine. So the scope issue never came up in Wren. They simply said, well, it was a motor vehicle violation. It was objectively reasonable. That's the end of the issue. In Caldwell, of course, the court then went on and saying, well, okay, we will say, fine, objectively reasonable in its inception, and then we will deal with the so-called pretext issue in the police officer's subsequent actions. If they exceed the scope of this routine traffic violation, which brings us to this case, did the officers exceed the scope of a routine traffic violation after they had seen the seatbelt violation? Now, the tip, they received this from another officer that there was, be on the lookout. They didn't, the other officer didn't say stop this car. He said, be on the lookout for this white Mercury Marquis, suspected drug dealing from a confidential source. And everybody agrees that this is not a past-proven reliable informant. And the two officers, Goldman and Jackson, weren't operating at the instructions of Corporal Shepard, who received the information. So they're just on the lookout for the white Mercury Marquis. And had they not had this tip, they wouldn't have given that white Mercury Marquis when it drove by a second glance, no doubt. But they did, because this is a white Mercury Marquis. They were told to be on the lookout for it. It's in your area. They saw it, and Officer Golden noted that the passenger was not wearing a seatbelt. This gave them an objectively reasonable reason to stop the car, which they did. Did they, at this point, from this point on, exceed the scope? Well, we know from Caldwell and Loper that they can ask the not only the driver but the passengers for their identities. They can then run warrant checks to see if there's any outstanding warrants. And, of course, with Mr. Turner, there was an outstanding warrant. There was a KPSF for his arrest. So this is going to extend the scope of the traffic stop long enough to effectuate a custodial arrest of one of the passengers. So it's no longer just a standard routine traffic stop. There were other observations, the extreme nervousness of the driver, Mr. Tan, and the bag of sandwich bags open, are things that combined with this unknown tip of a tip of unknown reliability did arouse suspicions. But again, the only other thing they did at this point was command, which they can do during the scope of a routine traffic stop, get passengers and driver out of the car, which they did. And at this point, and a number of things happened simultaneously, Mr. Holmes in the back seat as he gets out of the car is carrying so much drugs in his pocket that Officer Golden can see in there and say, geez, he carried a lot of drugs in his pocket. And I agree with Ms. Aronson, the sequence here is that Officer Jackson tells driver Tan to run out of the car, and at that point he reaches down, probably in retrospect, since he had a lot of drugs under the seat, this is to make sure that they're not visible rather than reach for a weapon. But Jackson says, I thought maybe he was reaching for a weapon, so I grabbed him and put him in handcuffs. But again, the sequence there, it's not, nothing really comes of this, because at this point in this sequence, all kinds of things are happening. They see the drugs. And as the trial judge said, Judge Johnson said, you know, at this point, they have probable cause. So not only the tip, but they have the drugs in Holmes' pocket. They have the money in Turner's, a large quantity of cash. And we have, so it's obviously a mobile drug emporium they're dealing with here. And they have probable cause to search the car for whatever else they can find. So, again, it's the state's position that the stop was reasonable in its inception, that the police did have probable cause based on their observations, regardless of whatever their other subjective motivations they may have had. They at least had reasonable suspicion for this very minor violation, admittedly, but they could stop the car. Mr. Tan, under the statute, the driver, was responsible for the violation. As the captain of the ship, he was responsible for making sure all his passengers were properly belted in. And so there was a reason for the stop, and that nothing that the police did before this cavalcade of evidence fell upon them, giving them a reason to search, nothing that they did exceeded the scope of a routine traffic violation. And that's the state's position. Just a few words about the other issue raised by Mr. Tease, the accomplice liability instruction. And I think it's, and the principal accomplice, the Delaware Criminal Code commentary, I think it's very clear that in Delaware, our accomplice liability statutes have gotten rid of any formal or nice distinction between principal and accomplice. And in this case, very obvious, all our principals in this business enterprise and all are helping out each other, so all are accomplices. As far as conspiracy goes, not all accomplices, of course, are conspirators, but all conspirators are accomplices. It's certainly possible for one person to engage in criminal activity that is beating up somebody and for another person just to come in and say, hey, let me give you a baseball bat and help you out. Well, that person is an accomplice. There's no prior conspiracy to do this. But here, all are engaged by separation of labor. Mr. Tan does the individual sales. Mr. Turner holds the cash, and Mr. Holmes has the inventory in this mobile enterprise. The court has no questions. I think I've made the state's position clear.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Objectively, the officer's actions in this case indicate this was a traffic stop. It was a detention. If there were questions raised, hunches raised, as a result of certain things located or determined during the course of that traffic stop, including the baggies on the back seat or the cash on Mr. Turner, a reasonable investigative measure would have been to ask Mr. Tan or Mr. Holmes or Mr. Turner some questions. Rather than doing that, once all purposes related to the stop and the issuing of a ticket, when those two individuals have no warrants against them, Tan is immediately placed in custody. He's handcuffed while he's seated in the car. And at that point, there's no probable cause to arrest him. The probable cause to search the car flows from...
Have you agreed with when the drugs were observed? Weren't the drugs observed before the handcuffing?
No. They were observed when Mr. Holmes was taken out of the back seat. But Mr. Tan, they asked him to exit first. He reaches under the seat. He's immediately handcuffed while he's in the car. And Mr. Holmes is also taken out by another officer immediately thereafter.
Isn't there a reasonable basis to worry about a weapon under the seat under that circumstance?
There is. But he doesn't make any furtive movements until after he's commanded to exit the vehicle and after everything checks out and he should have simply been issued a ticket. I mean, he could have been removed from that vehicle. There are five officers at this scene. He could have been removed from that vehicle and a Terry frisk performed, as would have been a constitutional measure at that point. But that's not what happened. They immediately arrested him.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Tease? All right, thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.